From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Our global roundtable is back with us today to discuss the world's news. But first, we're going to start right here in the United States with the latest on Hurricane Dorian. Are you in Dorian's path? Have you evacuated? We want to know what it's like where you are. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And let's go straight to Miami, where Brian McNulty joins us. He's Senior Research Associate in Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. Brian, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magnus. Thank you.
So we'll talk about what's in store for the southeastern United States in a second. But first, Brian, if I could, I'd like to focus a little bit on the Bahamas right now, because as we've heard the Prime Minister of the Bahamas saying that they are experiencing historic damage there. Here's a little bit from the Bahamas Foreign Minister, Darren Henfield, talking to reporters last night about the destruction caused by Dorian, the devastating destruction. He was also warning his people who did not evacuate that they must stay inside their homes.
It is not safe to go outdoors. Power lines are down, lamp poles are down, trees are across the street. It is very dangerous to be outdoors if you don't have to be outdoors.
That's the Bahamas Foreign Minister, Darren Henfield, saying power lines are down, lamp posts are down, it's dangerous to be outdoors. So Brian McNulty, is the Bahamas going to get a break from Dorian?
Unfortunately, not real soon. It's just been an unimaginable thing to have happened there, to have a Category 5 hurricane just come in and stall over the Grand Bahama, basically, for 24 hours. Things will gradually improve as the storm starts to drift north, but as of now, it's just literally a drift, 1 mile per hour. So it's not in any hurry to leave those places who, of course, wanted to move away as quickly as possible, let things, you know, start to see what has happened and how to start trying to get people found and safe.
Mm-hmm. So that stalling of Dorian over the Bahamas means that they've been suffering from 120 mile an hour winds, if not more, and ceaseless rain lashing Grand Bahama, especially. Why did it stall for so long?
Yeah, there was a bit of, it was always forecast to come to a gradual stall and then turn north near the Florida coast. But the length of that stall was not really foreseen too well. And so what happened is the ridge to the north, which is what would help steer it west a little bit, and a trough to its north as well that's coming across the eastern U.S., that is what was kind of slowing down. And without the trough moving in to erode the ridge and allow the storm to move north, it just had nowhere to go. It basically, with all hurricanes, they're just along for the ride. Mm. They just ride these troughs and ridges and go with the flow, as the saying goes. And so when there is no flow, they can't go. And that's exactly what happened here.
Wow. Now, I'm seeing here that Dorian is being called one of the strongest storms on record in the Atlantic, but it's since been downgraded from Category 5.
Correct. Yeah, it's presently a Category 3 hurricane, and that's still an extremely strong hurricane, but it has weakened since its peak intensity. But at its peak intensity, it is way up there in the top three that we're aware of in the Atlantic.
Mm. Well, actually, about Dorian stalling, we have a comment on our website. A listener wants to know if a hurricane has stalled this long before.
Well, that's a good question. Offhand, I can't think of one, especially a strong hurricane like this that just came and basically remained stationary for 24 hours. It's certainly uncommon. a couple of recent examples of hurricanes that came in and made landfall and weren't in a hurry to move along. Of course, 1 year ago, almost exactly, September 14th, Hurricane Florence made landfall in North Carolina and lingered there for a few days, not perfectly stationary and not a Category 5. And then a year before that, we had Hurricane Harvey make landfall as a Category 4 near Rockport, Texas. It moved inland and weakened, but then it just, again, hung around that area of eastern Texas for, I believe it was just about a week, and just rained and rained and rained.
Yeah.
So it's not too unheard of to have these storms sit and linger, but to have a Category 5 come to a stop over you is just unimaginable.
Yeah. Now, we're remembering here how with Superstorm Sandy, for example, we didn't even need to have a hurricane class storm for huge amounts of damage and loss of life to occur. So as Dorian eventually moves, even if it's in its downgraded status, it seems as if the southeastern United States still has to be on very high alert.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is expected to weaken more. So by the time it starts moving, it probably will still be a Category 3 for a while longer, but later into, you know, the end of the week, it should weaken more. But the important thing is to not pay attention to just that. There is still a very large threat, even from a weaker hurricane. A hurricane is still strong, so, you know, to call it a weaker hurricane doesn't mean it's of no concern. So, yeah, we are still looking at a very significant threat all along the coast from central Florida up into North Carolina by the end of the week. And they're wise to be doing what they're doing. They're getting people away from the coast.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that point, let's listen to National Hurricane Center Director Ken Graham. Yesterday, in a press briefing, he told folks along the Carolina coasts, along Georgia and parts of Florida, to evacuate if their local municipalities are telling them to do so. And to your point, Brian, Ken Graham said that even if Dorian is downgraded, it's an extremely dangerous storm.
Historically, 50% of fatalities, storm surge is a very dangerous situation. Pay attention to it. Again, the officials tell you to leave and leave early because that water gets there before the storm does.
The water gets there before the storm does. Brian, I mean, you're there in Miami. Have you heard from elsewhere, let's say even in Florida, if the water's starting to get there?
Absolutely. Yeah, even down here, and we're pretty far south from where the impacts are. We've been experiencing a little bit of we're having pretty high tides now, but we're getting some of this wind effect also even down here. So certainly further north, you know, from like the Cape Canaveral region, they will start to see these impacts real soon if they haven't yet.
So what is can you tell us what the best guess on the forecasted track of Dorian is going to be over the next couple of days?
Yeah, it's looking more and more likely that the eye wall and eye will remain offshore. It's not a sure thing yet, but it's looking likely. And while that is good news, it still brings that risk of wind-blown ocean, which is what a storm surge is, that risk is still there, even if the storm eye and eye wall remain offshore.
Well, here is ABC News meteorologist Ginger Z showing a video today on Good Morning America of a man getting pushed off a pier by a wave and into raging waters. I mean, Ginger was saying it's a warning, really, to heed official warnings about storm surges.
It is only going to get worse. The beach is not the place, and certainly not a pier or jetty that goes out, because this angry sea is coming from a hurricane that we have seen what damage it can do. So storm surge warnings do extend up along the coast.
That's ABC News meteorologist Ginger Zee. I'm joined by Brian McNulty. He is Senior Research Associate in Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Miami Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. Brian, you were just saying a second ago that the eye wall of Dorian might stay off the coast, but how many more days is this storm going to have an effect on the southeast, or even just the east coast of the United States in total? Is this something that we're going to have to keep our eye on for the whole rest of the week?
Yes, it will still be something. It's going to gradually work its way north, and then so by Thursday and Friday is when we'd be looking into the South Carolina and North Carolina areas. But for the remainder of Tuesday, or, you know, basically Tuesday into all day Wednesday, we've got the east coast of Florida that's at pretty high risk.
Mm. And how, I should have started by asking, how are you doing and storm prep and all of that?
Well, yeah, I appreciate that. We're pretty ready for something much worse, you know, just in case. We were never at a high risk down here of something happening, but there was certainly a risk, and people here were, they got ready for it. So I think people here are relieved that this, the storm is not ours.
Yeah. Well, I'm seeing that the mayor of Miami-Dade County is collecting, saying the county will be collecting items to send to the Bahamas to help with the devastation there. So Brian McNulty, Senior Research Associate in Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Miami Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. I appreciate it. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll have our global roundtable with a lot of news from around the world. So stick with us. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We're going to spend the rest of the hour today with our global roundtable and a raft of major world news. In the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing a revolt from members of his own party over Brexit. The U.S. trade war with China heats up even further. Protesters in Hong Kong are holding fast in the face of a China that swears it won't back down. And the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan says a peace deal may be near there in America's longest ever war. So you can join the conversation. What international stories are holding your attention now? We want to hear about it. Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And we've got a terrific panel joining us today. With us from Hong Kong is Keith Bradshaw, Shanghai Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Keith, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much for having me on.
It's great to have you. Also with us from London is Adrian Woolridge, political editor and Badgett columnist for The Economist. Adrian, it's good to have you.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And with us from Washington is Susan Glasser. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, founder of Politico magazine, and former editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy as well. Susan, welcome to you.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Okay, so let's start off with the latest tumult over Brexit. As I mentioned, Prime Minister Boris Johnson facing quite a serious revolt from his own party, the Conservative Party. Here he is just yesterday saying there are no circumstances under which he will accept another delay to Brexit.
I don't think they will. I hope that they won't. But if they do, they will plainly chop the legs out from under the UK position and make any further negotiation absolutely impossible.
That's Prime Minister Boris Johnson just yesterday. So, Adrian, let's start with you. What is happening in the UK Parliament right now?
That's a hard question. We basically have a political hurricane called Brexit. And the problem with this political hurricane is it gets stronger and stronger every day and is blowing away a lot of the things that we've taken for granted in Britain about constitutional government, parliamentary government and the rest of it. We have on a deep level, what we have is a clash between two forms of democracy. One is direct democracy through the referendum, whereby mm-hmm. people voted by a small majority to leave the EU. And the other is representative democracy, whereby a lot of MPs have doubts about leaving the EU. On a more immediate level, we have a vote this evening whereby Parliament is going to try to tie the Prime Minister's hands and tell him he's not allowed to take Britain out of the EU without a deal. And that will consist of the opposition parties, the Labour Party, the Scots Nats, the Liberal Democrats, but also, crucially, a significant number of Tory rebels who are not willing to support their party in taking Britain out of the EU without a deal.
So, Adrian, let me ask you, is Boris Johnson facing a different group of Tory rebels than Theresa May was in her multiple attempts to get her deal through the UK Parliament? I mean, because it seems like they didn't like Theresa May's deal, and now a different cohort doesn't like the prospect of a no deal Brexit. But either way, is the fracture within the Conservative Party really the issue here?
To some extent. Okay. What you have under Theresa May, most of the most vigorous rebels were members of the European Research Group of hardline Brexiteers who didn't want to compromise over Brexit. They thought her Brexit deal was Brexit in name only. Now what we have is a slightly smaller group of more moderate Tory MPs who don't want to leave without a deal, who think that we have to leave, but we have to leave with a deal. For example, Philip Hammond, who's in many ways the leader of this group of rebels, was only a few weeks ago the Chancellor of the Exchequer and a key lieutenant of Theresa May. So the party, the Rebel Alliance this time round is the inverse of the Rebel Alliance last time round.
Well, Susan, let me turn to you on this, because it seems as if Prime Minister Johnson, his line of argument is that having this October 31st deadline for Brexit is the equivalent, okay, a little editorializing here, but I can't help it, the equivalent of him sprinkling magical fairy dust on Brussels to get a better deal for the UK. I mean, how do you read this?
Well, fairy dust is as good of an analogy as anything. Obviously, I'm here in Washington, where we have our own political hurricane, Adrian, and it's settled over us for at least 4 years and for four more. And it's one interesting dynamic, right, is that, as you pointed out, the coalition opposing Boris Johnson is now sort of the inverse of the one mm-hmm. that was causing Theresa May so many problems from inside her own Conservative Party. There's also, I think, the flip-flop where President Trump went from essentially being a problem for Theresa May to now smothering Boris Johnson in his affection and embrace, but in a way that I think is probably also equally likely to disappoint. President Trump offers lots of praise for Boris Johnson, unlike the criticism he offered to Theresa May, but he's unlikely to produce a lot of concrete boons. Essentially, this is a situation where the world is sort of watching this internal turmoil, but is highly unlikely to be able to offer any kind of external aid. There's no one coming to the rescue here of Great Britain. They did it to themselves. And, it seems to me from a distance across the pond that they're not very close to figuring it out.
Well, Keith, let me turn to you. I mean, how do you see all this from Hong Kong?
I think people in Hong Kong have been watching with interest developments on Brexit, because it does have an indirect effect on the issue here. There's still considerable nostalgia in Hong Kong among particularly the English-speaking, fluently English-speaking minority here, for the days of British colonial rule up through 1997. And to the extent that Britain is deeply divided and distracted with Brexit now and is not paying attention to the efforts of many in Hong Kong to defend the rule of law and other traditions that they perceive as having inherited from those days, then that is a little discouraging to some people in Hong Kong. So, for example, on Sunday, I happened to see a protest outside the British consulate here, and there were hundreds of people waving even British flags, which does not go over well in Beijing, and even the British colonial flag, which goes over even less well in Beijing, and calling for the British government to support their cause, and also calling for the British government to give them more British passports. So one cause of continuing resentment here is that when Britain left in 1997, it only handed out 50,000 British passports to people whom it particularly judged as likely to have earned them, and then handed out something like 3 million so-called British national overseas passports, which do not give the right for people to go live in Britain and have very, very limited representation by British consulates if they get into trouble elsewhere.
Wow.
And which are not really recognized by China. But there's been much less discussion, I think, in Britain of the Hong Kong issue than there would have been if Brexit were not happening right now.
Right. If the entire nation, if the UK wasn't completely paralyzed by Brexit. Before we leave the Brexit issue, Adrian, let me turn back to you on one more thing here. Every single conversation I've had over the past couple of years regarding Brexit, the person that I talk to inevitably says, we are in uncharted territory. That is absolutely true here. But right at this point in time, we have Boris Johnson, as we said, facing the Tory revolt or Tory rebels. There's the possibility of Johnson calling a new election. There's the suspension of Parliament, which I believe is being challenged in British courts right now. I mean, dare you give me a prediction on whether or not Brexit is going to happen on October 31st?
The default position is that we leave the European Union on October 31st, whether we have a deal or not. And in a state of huge confusion and volatility, I think you have to think that the default option is the most likely to happen. But before then, we could have an enforced extension. There's a vote on that tonight, and the rebels, I think, look as though they've got the number. We could have a general election, which will complicate things even further. So the truth is that nobody knows. We could even end up having another referendum and reversing the whole thing. But I was very intrigued by what Keith Bradshaw was saying, because people looking at Britain as an example of the rule of law and constitutional government, well, we're testing our rule of law and we're testing constitutional government. The suspension of Parliament is something that many people find deeply upsetting. We've had huge protests in the streets of our own, not as anything like on the scale of Hong Kong, but significant levels of protests. We even had the former head of Chancellor of the head of the legal system, Michael Gove, saying that even if the Parliament votes to extend the deadline, that the government may not obey that rule, may not obey that piece of legislation. So, flirting with disobeying rules made in Parliament. So this clash between direct democracy and representative democracy really goes to the question of what is the legitimate basis of power. So it's testing the British Constitution in a way that it hasn't been tested for a century.
Wow. So the basic presumptions of what governance means in the UK. Fascinating. Well, we are talking about major issues in the world news this hour. We've got a terrific global roundtable with us. You're hearing Adrian Woolridge, Susan Glasser, and Keith Bradshaw. And we want to know what your questions are about news from around the world. We'll be talking about Hong Kong and China in just a second. What about the trade war going on between the U.S. and China? And there seems to be a glimmer that there's a possibility of a peace agreement. The U.S. envoy to Afghanistan says that might be possible. Can you imagine an end to U.S. involvement in the longest war we've been in U.S. history? Let's go to Greg, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi. My concern is that I have a daughter who's a senior at the Savannah College of Art and Design, and she and her classmates are all making their way to the Hong Kong campus this week. And they're not getting any information about the deteriorating situation between Hong Kong and China from the school or from the State Department. And I reached out to the school before, and they assured that there is some kind of emergency plan to get the kids out if a government crackdown a la Tiananmen Square or Tibet should occur. But, you know, we can see that China's massing troops on the Hong Kong border, and the escalating protests mean that this situation will likely not end well.
Yeah.
And so I'm worried that we're, you know, the students are excited about being in Hong Kong and being at the center of a global sort of situation, but they weren't even born when Tiananmen Square happened.
Right. So, Greg, let me get Keith Brad. Yeah, and I appreciate your call. And so, Keith Bradshaw is right there in Hong Kong for us. So, let me get a response to what Greg is saying here. Keith, first of all, as Greg mentioned, there was this troop rotation, Chinese troop rotation in Hong Kong. I don't know if we could call it an amassing of Chinese troops. I mean, what's the latest on that?
They did move a bunch more soldiers in, and the soldiers they are replacing have not yet left to the extent that anybody can see. And therefore, temporarily, there is a handover period every year when they have more soldiers here. That said, most people are not expecting any kind of military intervention here. The situation you're seeing here is fundamentally different from what happened at Tiananmen Square, and then, for that matter, what happened in Prague with the Soviets going in 68, or in Hungary with the Soviets going in 56. In those cases, and particularly Tiananmen, you had the local population, including police, all protesting. In Hong Kong, what has been somewhat unusual is the extent to which the protesters began confronting the police early on and then turned strongly against the police over what they perceived as excessive use of force by the police. So the Hong Kong police did not use as much force as American police might use in dealing with an unruly crowd, but they did use more force than has been traditional here. And so that provoked a lot of attacks, not just on police, but even, for example, attacks against the apartment blocks that hold policemen's families. Police officers' families have had rocks thrown through their windows, even fired through their windows by large two-person slingshots. You've had the police officers' cars vandalized. You've had the spouses of police officers getting identified online and then receiving hundreds of hostile emails and messages. The result of all that is that the police officers in Hong Kong are furious right now. And they have been more than happy to take on the protesters in, unfortunately, what have been some really nasty clashes. However, to answer your question, Greg, I don't think you need to be that concerned at this point. And first of all, because neither Beijing nor the Hong Kong government sees a need to send in mainland soldiers. The Hong Kong police have the ability to do more than they're doing now if they wished to control the protests. Second of all, these protests are fairly confined and remarkably disciplined. For example, you might have seen on your television screen scenes of fires, and yet even those were done with carefully piled up barricades in the middle of a street intersection, not too near the edges where they might catch a building on fire, and no buildings were caught on fire. So those were more, to me, they were more like bonfires than protest bonfires than they were setting the city ablaze, as some people were melodramatically putting it.
Well, Keith, hang on here for just a second. Sorry to interrupt there, Keith, but I just want to get Susan back in here briefly for a second, because, you know, I'm listening to all that Keith is saying, and I take his point about China not wanting to do a Tiananmen-style crackdown in Hong Kong for a multiplicity of reasons. But in addition to that, though, I mean, these protests are in their, what, their 13th, 14th week? I mean, we've got a minute to go before the break, Susan, but how long can this persist before China's view changes?
Well, that's what's interesting. I mean, it's already surpassed the most recent previous eruption of protests. Remember the Yellow Umbrella Movement. So it's gone on for a long period of time, and it seems to be getting new recruits who are drawn to the streets by the ferocity and tenacity of those who are already there. So I think that's an important question at a time when, remember, there's an escalating trade war between China and the United States, too. So it's a significant geopolitical moment.
Well, we will come back to the issue of that trade war in just a second. We are talking with our Global News Roundtable about news you need to know from around the world. We want to take your questions. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with our Global News Roundtable about stories from around the world that we all should be paying closer attention to. I'm joined by Adrian Woolridge. He's political editor and Badgett columnist for The Economist. Susan Glasser joins us. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker. And Keith Bradshaw is with us. He is the Shanghai bureau chief for The New York Times. He's with us from Hong Kong. And Susan's in Washington, and Adrian is in London. And we want to know what your questions are for our panel about stories around the world that you want to know more about. We've been talking about Hong Kong and the pro-democracy protests going on there. This is the 13th week of those protests. And here's Isaac Cheng. He's vice chair of a pro-democracy organization called Democisto, speaking to Sky News.
If they suppress us more, we'll resist more. And if they try to kill us with the rebels, just let us burn together.
Well, on the other hand, we have a listener on our website calling themselves Win, who says Hong Kong is a province of China and Beijing will decide its fate. End of story. Adrian Woolridge, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that what you have here is, you know, two long-term conflicts intensifying. One is that China is becoming more authoritarian, more centrally controlled, and more of a muscle-bound military power, and that the students are sort of self-radicalizing. I mean, they're part of a generation that's been brought up in the light of Western liberal values, and in the process of protesting, I think they're becoming more self-assertive. So I think you have two very powerful forces headed for conflict.
Hmm. Well, let's go to Carol, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Carol, you're on the air.
Hi. I blame technology in part for the unrest in the U.S. and all over the world. You know, how it's dominating everything and now stealing jobs. More jobs, not just low-wage jobs. If anyone's had surgery recently, they may have realized that there was a robotic assistant. Off the air.
Yeah, so Carol, thank you for your call. Keith Bradshaw, let me turn to you on that. I mean, I think Carol's she blames technology and its impact on jobs and the economy as a unifying factor in the unrest that she's seeing around the world. What do you make of that?
Two answers. I'm not sure that technology is so much responsible for job losses in Hong Kong as that the rising level of competitiveness of mainland China itself has meant that Hong Kong has lost some of its advantage in some areas. So it's become harder, for example, for Cantonese and English-speaking would-be bankers, young bankers, or other people who want to get jobs in the financial sector to compete with people who speak Mandarin and English, because there's more Mandarin, which is the main dialect on the mainland, spoken. The separate question, though, is how has technology changed the protests themselves? And here in Hong Kong, it's changed them in two important ways. On the one hand, it's easier to organize a protest. These very fluid groups of young people who are coordinating through social media, through setting up chat rooms, and very quickly deciding where to move to a new location to hold their protests, so as to, even in the course of the evening, changing locations, that keeps the police off balance. On the other hand, the downside of technology is that these chat rooms make it almost impossible for anybody to emerge as a clear leader and then strike compromises or deals with the government. So the government finds itself unable to even really negotiate on any of the issues. And when people have tried to make even a suggestion of compromise, even to the point of, for example, saying, well, should we be quite so violent in doing X, Y, and Z? They tend to be shouted down in these online forums.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is very difficult for a leader to it's easy to start a protest, but it's hard to control it, and it's hard to reach a negotiated settlement.
Interesting. Well, let's switch gears here a little bit and talk about the other major issue between China and the United States in particular. Susan, you talked about it for a second before, and that is the latest in the trade war because, of course, just this weekend, there was a new round of tariffs, some 15% tariffs being slapped on about $100 billion of Chinese goods coming to the United States. Beijing had those retaliatory tariffs on $75 billion worth of U.S. goods. So here's the president speaking to reporters on the South Lawn of the White House on Sunday, defending the tariffs.
As you know, some new tariffs get on. We're taking in tens of billions of dollars. We're giving some of the money to the farmers. I'm making the farmers more than whole. The farmers are doing better than if China, frankly, were buying.
Susan Glasser, the president says American farmers are doing better than if China was actually just buying their goods. What do you think?
Well, you know, that's not even a full sentence, but there's a couple different things to fact check in it. First of all, there continues to be Trump, you know, misrepresenting what a tariff is and treating it as though it's some sort of a tax where, you know, the Chinese are just going to pay him direct money because he imposes tariffs on him. That's obviously not how it works. And then also this question of whether American farmers are benefiting. Consistent reporting, lead story in The Wall Street Journal today, bastion of anti-Trumpism, suggesting that, in fact, farmers in the United States and around the globe are beginning to feel the negative effects of this tariff war. And increasingly, those are people at the heart of President Trump's political coalition. So it's an interesting political dynamic for him that he's chosen to continue escalating with China as we get closer and closer to the 2020 reelection fight. And so he's claiming something that doesn't seem to be basis in reality in this particular case. But again, what's striking is that in August, I think we all saw in a month of sort of dizzying back and forth, Trump proclaimed repeatedly to be on the brink of a deal, which never happened. And actually, that's been the case for more than a year, that he has repeatedly thought he had made a deal or was about to with the Chinese, and they've refused to do so. And, you know, I feel like we're now in a situation where we have to judge the prospects for an actual major agreement between China and the United States, as opposed to some perhaps holding pattern, to be more and more remote as China and other world actors increasingly will say, why not wait it out? Why not see whether Trump is going to lose re-election or win re-election next year? That becomes its own dynamic, I think, in international affairs over the next year, number one. Number two, of course, will this drive an economic slowdown in the United States? Up until now, that's been the major factor preventing Trump from having even lower ratings. And that is, if he does win re-election, I think it will be because of the strength of the economy. So if that slows down and if the tariffs and the trade war with China are seen to be a key reason for the slowdown, that's an enormous political blow to
but
the president.
Susan, let me ask you, though. I mean, on the China side of things, though, the tariffs are having an impact there, too. And China, while, of course, massive, it doesn't have a limitless capacity to absorb the economic impact and pain from these U.S. tariffs. I mean, how long?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's an important point because, you know, really, you could say that this is a game of who will blink first. The United States or China? And that is a question. It's an important question. Remember that's why I keep bringing up politics, because there are politics, of course, in China, but Xi Jinping has a lot stronger hand in terms of his ability to make command decisions without having to worry so much about the daily or even hourly political commentary, which seems to so obsess in which the president of the United States is immersed. So I think the fact that we have different political systems is very directly relevant to the question of what, you know, what each country will do as they face this confrontation.
Okay, well, let's go to back to our callers. Tommy is calling from Springfield, Illinois. Tommy, you're on the air.
Hi. My question has to do with whether the trade negotiation that's going on right now between America and Japan, the new trade deal between America and Japan, will have any significant effect upon the trade war with China and America, and that particularly that effect, will it have an effect on American farmers? Will it provide any real relief to American farmers?
Tommy, thank you for your call. Keith Bradshaw, is that one that you want to take on?
Sure, I'd be happy to do so. The pending trade agreement between Japan, which has not been finalized, does call for a little bit of liberalization of American farm access to the Japanese market. However, the Japanese market is tiny compared to the Chinese market. Among other things, Japan has a little less than one-tenth of the population of China. There is one aspect that hasn't been brought up yet, which is underpinning part of this, though, which is why was it that China was importing so much in the way of American soybeans and also some American corn? It's not for human consumption. China has very strong limits on how much it'll import of human food because it wants to maintain food security. So it's primarily being used in China's animal feed. And the main protein source in China is pigs. And you've had half the pigs in China, hundreds of millions of pigs, die in the past few months of African swine fever. And that has depressed global demand for soybeans, which are heavily used in animal feed. So American farmers were going to take something of a hit here, regardless of whether there was a trade war. And it's very hard to distinguish the effects of a big chunk of the world's pig population dying from, because after all, China had half the world's pigs, as many pigs as the rest of the world combined, and then a quarter of them died, and then half of those died. So a quarter of the global pig supply has died.
Wow.
Which is unbelievable. Oh. And in very, very quick order from this, what they call some people call the Ebola, porcine Ebola, in the sense that it's so deadly among pigs.
Well,
so
you
it's
know,
really a tragedy on the farms.
I want to pull Adrian Woolridge back into this conversation because you're sitting there in London, and not to bring it back to Brexit, but if the UK does indeed exit the European Union, like this is the trading environment that it's going to be diving into as a solo negotiator. I mean, what do you make of it?
Well, sure, it's an exceptionally difficult environment, and we are, as a separate country, much weaker than we were as part of the European Union. So recently we tried to, as it were, import the deal that the Europeans had just made with Japan. The Europeans have just signed a big trade deal with Japan. And we said, well, we'll just copy it. We'll import it whole. And that will be our first big move after Brexit. And the Japanese said no. Wait a minute, we're not going to negotiate the same deal with a small country that we've just negotiated with a big power because, you know, we're stronger, you're weaker, and we shouldn't be doing it. You know, on the other hand, I think that President Trump has a big incentive to do a trade deal with Britain, partly because he wants to pull Britain away from Europe. He doesn't like Europe. He regards it as like sort of the Democratic Party writ large and speaking foreign languages. And he would like to do that. And he would like to help us in that sort of way. But against that is the fact that obviously trade deals take a lot of time to push through, and you have to get agreement with Congress and lots of other participants in the game. So you're absolutely right. We're entering into a very, very difficult and unpleasant environment at a very bad time when the global economy is slowing down.
Well, one last caller here. Let's go to Dick, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Dick, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to ask your guests about the peace agreement that's going on in Afghanistan, whether they think that this is a ploy by Donald Trump heading into the election, and if the Taliban would stand behind any kind of peace agreement in Afghanistan.
Yeah,
I'll take my answer offline.
Thank you for your call. So, Susan, let me turn to you. Just to give folks some details here, just yesterday, Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. envoy, said that there's a peace agreement in principle, quote, in principle, the president has to approve it. It could mark the beginning of the end of America's involvement in Afghanistan, including a drawdown of U.S. troops there. What do you think, Susan?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad we brought this up because it is significant. I do believe that President Trump would like to have this as a deliverable, in effect, before his re-election campaign, and that it would be a part of what he runs on in 2020, the idea that he said he would get the United States focused on things here at home and withdraw from these wars of essentially the last few presidencies. And so I think he's willing to make peace. The question is at what cost? It's always been the case. And, you know, what I understand from my reporting is that Ambassador Khalilzad has a pretty free hand to negotiate this and has really been given a wide agenda by the president to make this happen, and that he's really doing this, that he's working closely with President Trump, who sees this as a personal priority. And, you know, the question is, again, what is the net effect in terms of the gains, for example, among women, among girls who are now allowed to go to school, things like that. Will there be a reversion to the Taliban of the pre-9/11 status quo? And then there's also the security question. ISIS remains alive, not only in the Middle East, but in Afghanistan as well. There was a very deadly attack just last week in Kabul that was a reminder of the power of some of these groups. And this is, many people fear, an exact rerun of history after the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan. Remember, the United States was essentially running a covert war there in order to tweak the Soviet superpower in Afghanistan. It was very successful. After the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan, so did the United States. Years of political chaos, military chaos, civil war followed. Into that vacuum is where al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden came as guests of the Taliban government that eventually emerged from that civil war and that fighting. And so a lot of people fear that that is a similar scenario to what we could see play out now, depending on what the terms are.
You got to exactly the point I was going to raise, that there's strong, potentially strong echoes of history here, that even as Khalilzad was making this announcement of an agreement in principle, we had Taliban-related attacks in places where the agreement requires security being reached before U.S. troops can start being brought home. So echoes of history are strong indeed. And we've got to wrap up with that, I'm afraid. So Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker with us from Washington, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Keith Bradshaw, Shanghai bureau chief for The New York Times with us from Hong Kong. Keith, thank you.
Thank you.
And Adrian Woolridge, political editor and Badgett columnist for The Economist, with us from London. Adrian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, and Grace Tatter, with help from Jeffrey Lyne, David Marino, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.